Coming up next on Passion Struck.
We can't look to what our generations are facing as the cause of something, because social media is good. So is radio, so is television, so is AI. So they're not the problem. The problem is, what are we doing with them? The problem is, how are we managing them? Instead of looking to an external cause as the cause of something like mental health, external causes do impact mental health, but it's blaming something without looking at the benefits of it. So it's about management of it. So social media is not bad, it's how we're managing it.
Welcome to Passion Struck. Hi, I'm your host, John R. Miles. And on the show, we decipher the secrets, tips, and guidance of the world's most inspiring people and turn their wisdom into practical advice for you and those around you. Our mission is to help you unlock the power of intentionality so that you can become the best version of yourself. If you're new to the show, I offer advice and answer listener questions on Fridays. We have long-form interviews the rest of the week with guests ranging from astronauts to authors, CEOs, creators, innovators, scientists, military leaders, visionaries, and athletes. Now, let's go out there and become Passion Struck. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to episode 329 of Passion Struck, ranked by Apple as one of the top 10 most popular health podcasts and the number one alternative health podcast. And thank you to each and every one of you who come back weekly to listen and learn how to live better, be better, and impact the world. Passion Struck is now on syndicated radio on the AM/FM 247 national broadcast. Catch us on your evening commute Monday and Friday from 5 to 6 p.m. Eastern Time. Links will be in the show notes. If you're new to the show, thank you so much for being here. Or you simply want to introduce this to a friend or a family member, we now have episode starter packs, which are collections of our fans' favorite episodes that we organize into convenient topics that give any new listener a great way to get acclimated to everything we do here on the show. Either go to Spotify or passionstruck.com/starterpacks to get started. And in case you missed it, last week I interviewed Dr. Hitendra Wadhwa, author of the groundbreaking book, Inner Mastery, Outer Impact, How Your Five Core Energies Hold the Key to Success. Dr. Wadhwa introduces a powerful framework for achieving success that starts from within, specifically focusing on what he calls one's inner core. I also interviewed nurse practitioner and intermittent fasting expert Cynthia Thurlow. In her groundbreaking book, Intermittent Fasting Transformation, Cynthia unveils game-changing approach to intermittent fasting designed specifically for women, but it's also applicable to the men in our audience as well. I also wanted to say thank you so much for your ratings and review. If you love today's episode or either of the others that I mentioned, we would so appreciate you giving us a 5-star rating and review and sharing it with your friends and families. I know we and our guests love to see comments from our listeners. Today, we have an amazing interview where we delve into a critical topic that affects the lives of children everywhere, their mental health. As a parent of two children myself, I know firsthand that kids are facing unprecedented challenges with rising levels of anxiety and depression impacting their well-being. As caretakers, educators, and concerned individuals, it's our responsibility to equip our young ones with the tools that they need to navigate their emotional landscape and build resilience. And who better to guide us on this journey than the esteemed Dr. Caroline Leaf, a renowned neuroscientist, communication pathologist, audiologist, and the host of the award-winning podcast, Cleaning Up the Mental Mess. Dr. Leaf has dedicated her career to understanding the complexities of the human brain, and her groundbreaking research has paved the way for a deeper understanding of mental health and wellness. I am absolutely thrilled to have her on Passion Struck to discuss her latest book, How to Help Your Child Clean Up Their Mental Mess, A Guide to Building Resilience and Managing Mental Health. In this empowering episode, Dr. Leaf will share scientifically proven steps to empower children aged 3 to 10 to overcome unhealthy thinking habits and foster emotional well-being. Her 5-step plan is backed by cutting-edge clinical research interwoven with relatable stories and case studies, making it accessible and effective for caretakers like you and me. Together, we will explore vital insights, including warning signals to watch out for, the revolutionary neuropsycho method, the impact of different parenting styles, the significance of thought trees, and the fascinating workings of our children's brains during various activities. This episode promises to be a complete game changer for all of us who care deeply about the well-being of our children. So let's dive into this enriching conversation and discover how we can equip our young ones with the resilience and strength they need to survive. Thank you for choosing Passion Struck and choosing me to be your host and guide on your journey to creating an intentional life. Now, let that journey begin. I am so excited today to welcome Dr. Caroline Leaf on Passion Struck, someone who I've actually wanted to have on this podcast for a very long time. Welcome, Caroline.
Thank you so much, John. It's so great to meet you. And I love your podcast. I think the concept that you cover is so aligned with what I believe in and do as well. So it's very exciting to talk to you.
I'm excited to get into your brand new book, which releases today, which is How to Help Your Child Clean Up Their Mental Mess, A Guide to Building Resilience and Managing Mental Health. Congratulations on its release.
Thank you so much. We're very excited about it. It's been a big project. Writing books is a big project, but I just think what's even more important is just to help people feel empowered when it comes to mental health and helping your children with all the crisis at the moment.
Well, since we're going to be talking about children, I thought I would start at a point where I was a child. And I spent years growing up going through speech language pathology. It's still something that I honestly struggle with, as you might have just heard me do in the introduction. And I have to be very intentional about how I choose my words and thoughts. What led you to study logopedics?
I initially was going to do neurosurgery and medicine and that kind of line of direction, but then I was very interested in the whole neuroscience side. So there was an opportunity to do a degree that was a combination of medicine, communication, pathology. We did elements of audiology, psychology, neuroscience. It was a really interesting degree, and that just launched me into going further and further with my research. So it was a passion for the mind and understanding how the mind works and how to understand the brain, and it just drove me. And I started researching very early on. I mean, 38 years later, I'm still doing research. I practiced clinically for 25 years, and I've had the privilege of working with such a cross-section of different communication issues. So things like autism, dementias, severe trauma, and how that impacts our life, learning issues, all these things that are just the day-to-day struggles of humanity. And so, yeah, my scope has been pretty broad. Over the years, I started focusing in on the psychoneurobiological aspects. So now I'm in the field of psychoneurobiology, which is the mind-brain-body connection.
Yeah, it's interesting how you made that leap, because you went back and you got a master's and a PhD in communication pathology. What caused that shift for you?
I wasn't trained as a speech therapist. I was trained a communication pathologist, but they're a little bit different. You don't work directly on speech issues. You're working on a person's overall communication, and then you're tracking back to, you look at the whole person in context of how they're functioning and all the different, from the emotional, linguistic, everything, all the different aspects. And then you track back to what could be going on inside the mind, brain, body connection. And then how can you help the person in the whole context? I was in it immediately. As I said, I did quite a unique approach. I don't even have that degree anymore. The combination that I did, where we got all the different aspects. So the interest was launched from day one. And we were doing hospital rounds, and we were working with people in a very holistic way, literally from day one observation. But then once we were working in clinic, so I just continued in my studies in the same sort of line of direction, moving more into the neuroscientific aspect. So it wasn't really a change. It was more a continuation of what I had been exposed to. And I was really prompted to dive deeper with a neuroscience professor of ours that was telling us about how the brain can't change. So back in the 80s, they didn't believe that the brain could change. That was the going wisdom at that stage. In the 80s, what they did still teach and talk about was that the mind and the brain were separate. But once the brain was damaged, it was considered, well, that's it. So we were very trained to try and compensate for damage with our patients. And that for me sounded wrong. And I remember in that lecture thinking this, something's wrong, and putting up my hand and asking this professor, why, if we are constantly changing as humans, every day something new, every moment we're changing, the brain is what the mind uses. It's the organ that the mind works with. So the brain must change. And he basically said to me in quite a snarky way, well, go do research. So I said, okay, so what area? And he said, well, traumatic brain injury, which used to be called closed head injury. And I said, sure, why specifically that area? And he said, because there's very little research on it, because there's no point in researching the fact that the brain can't change. And that was all I needed to stimulate in interest. And I did some of the first prompting from that professor. I actually went into and did some of the first neuroplasticity research back in the late 80s and early 90s. And that's when my interest was sparked, that if you're working with someone with a traumatic brain injury or a trauma from life, then they may not necessarily have damage to their brain, but they've had damage in the experiences of their life, which they've processed through. It's going to affect how you function and show up. So immediately I expanded my research into incorporating and seeing where I can apply this in different areas. And as I said today, I'm still doing the research.
Unfortunately, I've had a number of them, both in sports where I played rugby collegiately, and then following that, combat trauma. And I know for a long time, the doctors were telling me that some of the ramifications of this were going to be permanent, but I have ended up finding ways through my own research to basically rewire my brain to get it back to almost where it was pre-injury.
John, when I hear that, I just get goosebumps and I get so excited and want to just say thank you. It's a congratulations and thank you for sharing this to the world, because this is, you are exactly the kind of person that I spent a large part of my career working with, because a lot of people, you had exactly the same kind of situation as you, where people were told, well, there's not much you can do. And so if you had a traumatic brain injury from, or it's chronic traumatic encephalopathy from sports injuries, plus, as you say, combat, which have been TBI combination, you literally would have been written off years ago, which is what happened with a lot of my patients that came into my studies. They were often told by the parents or the patients that this is a lifelong thing, you're not going to ever change, and you just got to learn to deal with it. And that's not true. You've shown that yourself, and I've shown that with my research and so many patients over the years and people over the years, that with your mind, you actually rewire the brain. The brain listens to the mind. So if you know how to manage your mind, you can change those psychoneurobiological networks. Now, it doesn't mean everything's perfect and doesn't mean everything goes away. And it's a constant battle, as you've experienced, and it's an ongoing process. But there's so much hope in that. So I really am very excited that you shared that with me. It's fantastic, because I know exactly what you're saying. I've worked with so many people that have pushed through, and that you can change how you function, and the evidence is in your life. It's fantastic.
Yeah, it is an interesting process, though, because I started on the outside being told time and time again that the issues I was experiencing didn't have anything to do with the traumatic brain injuries, because they couldn't find it on a typical MRI or a CT scan. But as you are well aware, it rarely shows up over a long period of time on those unless it's an acute injury at the time. I remember going to the VA and talking to their head of traumatic brain injury, who said TBIs aren't long lasting. And then I started doing my extensive research to find that concussion syndrome is a real thing, and especially in the special operators community and with athletes, and it is long lasting. And there were, in fact, 5 to 7 million people who had it in the United States. What I would encourage listeners, if you have experienced any of this, is don't listen to people who tell you that this information isn't accurate, because you can find help, whether it's hormonal treatment or rewiring your mind to get back to where you once were. And I'm using that to lead into, I think a lot of people think that the brain and the mind are one and the same. However, I like to think of it using this analogy. I have a background in information technology, so I think of the brain as hardware, and I think of the mind as software. Is that an appropriate way to think about it?
John, that's a very common way that people explain the mind and the brain difference, but it's not totally accurate. It's a basic good analogy. It's an idea. A better way of thinking of it, in my opinion, from what I know in all these years of being in the field, is a computer doesn't even closely simulate, for example, the brain. A computer can't even do what one neuron in the brain can do. And even AI is still stuck around that very basic level. So the complexity of the human brain, just the power of, like, for example, the connection between two neurons externally through the electromagnetic forces of the connections, is totally different to one neuron. So it's just infinite sort of power that we can't really capture inside a computer. And that's not even going inside the neuron. When you go inside a neuron, there's a whole different world of quantum physics and things that we deal with there, and permutations are infinite. So it's a very, very complex mechanism. And that's way beyond any computer's thing. But it's not a bad analogy to try and understand the difference. What I would think, software for me is still part of the physical, because, well, we're still very much part of the brain. Because if you think about software on a computer, you still need the human to create the software, and you still need the human to actually operate the computer. So there's something over and above the software and the computer, and it's at a much more complex level. So the mind would be that much more complex element that's driving the creation of the software, the creation of the complexity of the computer, and driving the computer. So another way that you could look at it is to think of the mind as your aliveness, your ability to think and feel and choose and respond from the moment you wake up to the moment you go to sleep. Even at night when you're sleeping, your mind is still active, working out your experiences during the day. And your brain as being the organ that the mind uses to basically store the information and then instruct the body, because everything goes into the brain and the body in different ways. and also into the mind. So the mind can also have a physics. It has a physics component, its gravitational fields, electromagnetic light forces, the quantum properties of vibrations, that we have a biofield. A very simple way of understanding this is if you put a QEEG, which is a system that I use in my research, a cap on someone's head, and link that to a QEEG machine, we are reading the brain's response. If it's a dead person and you put a QEEG on that dead person, there will be no response. So the response that we're seeing in the brain is because that person's alive and thinking while that QEEG is on their head. Or you put an EKG on someone's heart, even when they're alive, there's a reading. When they're not alive, there's no reading. So the things that make our body work and respond, that's mind. And also the mind is also our ability to actually process this conversation and have relationships, be a human alive and experiencing the world. So it's like our aliveness. And then brain and the body are this incredible complex, way beyond what computers can do at the moment, that have to be complex because the mind's so complex. And then the interrelationship of the three creates the magic that we see in humanity showing up.
I'm just blown away by that explanation. And I think you just did probably the best job I've heard on this podcast to describe the difference. So thank you for sharing that.
Oh, well, thank you. I appreciate that. That's been my fascination for 38 years. So hopefully I can explain it.
I understand one of the things that you were working on right now is some research around habits. And it just turns out that I released a solo episode on habit stacking. And speaking of the mind, I understand that our minds are wired in a way that makes micro habits or habit stacking a genius strategy for behavioral change. Can you discuss what your research is about and maybe go into synaptic pruning and some of the other aspects of habit formation?
Absolutely. Myself and my team, we are basically psychoneurobiologists. So we're looking at psycho, mind, brain, physical brain and body, mind, brain, body, psychoneurobiology. When we do studies, we'll take a whole complex behaviors that people are battling with. It's not a simple thing like learning to clean your teeth on time or wash your hands after a meal, whatever. You work with very complex, like, what is your story? What is, you've been through combat, you're going to have a whole lot of traumatic stories. We look at you as a holistic, you and your whole story, your whole narrative. So we'll look at the story, we'll look at the psychological elements like self-regulation, because self-regulation is so linked to how I'm managing my mind. If I can self-regulate, it means I can observe and I can manage how I'm reacting in situations. By management, I recognize the support I need, the changes I need to make, what I need to improve on, et cetera, what habits I need to build, et cetera, et cetera. That's all the psychological side. Then we look at the brain and we want to see how the brain is responding. And the reason I use QEEG and not MRI and fMRI, although they're fantastic tools as well, is because I want to see the energy response in pretty much real time and as accurately as possible. So you can't read, they don't tell you your thoughts. Brain scans and things aren't showing you what your brain is like in a fixed way. It's showing you how your brain's responding in the moment. So an fMRI done now and done in 2 hours' time is going to change. And QEEG done now and in 2 hours' time is going to change, even in 10 minutes later. So we must always have caution when we talk about measuring the brain, because we are looking at the brain's response in real time and then we're predicting from that. And then we also look at the biological impact. So because an experience like this conversation or any experience you have is being processed by the mind, this aliveness, this think, feel, choose energy, fantastically brilliant, ongoing, phenomenally fast, beyond space and time concept, our aliveness, it's capturing that information and putting that into the brain as a thought tree. So it changes the neuroplasticity of the brain. The brain can't change itself. The brain has to be changed. So the mind is doing the work of changing. So you with your mind take the information in, put it into your brain, and your brain grows the information. This conversation, for example, basically it causes an energy flow that collapses, and that makes little amino acids that group together to form proteins. And those proteins capture the information as vibration. So literally as I'm talking, my words or conversation are becoming tiny vibrations inside proteins and are growing into branch-like structures. The words we're saying are the roots. If you think of a tree, it's a tree-like structure. We're the source of this conversation. So it's the source of the experience. And then the listeners and the viewers, they've got the roots part, what we're saying, but the branches are how they interpret what we are talking about in terms of their own life experiences. So the trunk is their unique processing and the branches are how they understand this and how that's going to show up in their life. So that's just to give you that visual. So literally we build trees, thought trees made of data, and the data is the memories. So everything I'm saying to you and everything you say to me, that's data points, and that's which are memories, and they're clustering together to grow a tree. And the tree is this conversation between John and Caroline, whatever they've called it in them, whatever the person who's listening has called it, whatever the title of your podcast will be, generally the name of that cluster. As soon as that happens, it happens really fast, 400 billion actions plus per second, your brain then instructs the body, and every cell of the body, and we have 37 to 100 trillion cells in our brain and our body, they then capture the thought as well, but in a slightly different way, in terms of in every cell, there's like a skeleton, and that then it's made up, also made up of protein. So there's a representation of the memory forming in your brain in this tree-like structure, which is the neuroplasticity thing, the brain growing. That is also represented in every cell as a change in these little protein structures in the skeleton of the cell. And why am I saying all of that? That's because our experiences become embodied. And you know yourself from being a vet that PTSD, your entire body responds. It's not just your brain making you do something. It's actually an experience that's been embodied, mind, brain, and body. It's real, and it's never going to go away. But what we can do is we can change what it looks like inside of the mind, brain, body network. So we can change the trees. We can change the representation in our body. We can change the biofield of that memory. So if you think of a memory in three places, you can actually change it in three places. So the work that I do, looking at the psychology, the brain, and then also what's going on in the body in response. And there's many ways you can look in the body. You can look at hormones, you can look at different chemical reactions and so on. So we've selected some of the ones that are very established in the science literature in terms of being linked to how a person's managing chronic stress, whether they're a child or an adult. And that's things like prolactin, and in males and females are very closely associated with how we're managing and dealing with stuff that we've gone through and are going through, whether it's day-to-day struggles or whether it's really big stuff like combat trauma and so on. And then we also look at things like telomeres, which are the ends of chromosomes. And chromosomes are in your DNA, and telomeres, if I cross my fingers, they look like little X's, and my nails would represent telomeres. And they're very important because we are making new cells every second, somewhere between 800,000 and a million every second. And those cells basically are making our body. The telomeres influence that process, and telomeres are driven by our mind. So if we have a messy mind, it damages the telomeres, which means the cells are not as healthy as they could be. And over time, it's cumulative, and then our body's not as strong as it could be, and we become more vulnerable to disease. And this is why we see in the literature and in real life, very strong link between chronic unmanaged toxic stress and physical issues, trauma from childhood, trauma from combat, trauma from any kind of situation that's not fully managed will show up in physical ailments in the brain and the body, different for every person. So we look at that link and look to see if we can help a person manage their mind, and how does that change, and how does that link to change in terms of habits? Because as you, from your work and the podcast you've just done, a habit doesn't form in 21 days. Doesn't form in one day or 7 or 14. It forms in cycles of 21 days. And what we've shown with the literature, which is what scientists have been showing for a while now, but we've done a lot of intensive research in this area, it takes between 18 and 60 days, somewhere in that region, for us to start changing a behavior. 18 days is not enough if it's complex. 18 days would be something like, for something simple, I want to make sure that I get up every day and go to the gym. So I want to train myself to go to the gym every day. So it's that little routine you want to put in place. But something complex, like you've got a relationship issue with someone at work, or you're dealing with the trauma of going through combat, that's not going to go away in 18 days. It's not even going to go away in around 60 days. It's going to take multiple cycles of 60 days. So what we see is that behavior simple is around about 18 days to create change in the psychoneurobiological networks. And more complex is a minimum of in the region of 59 to 66 days. And then complex behaviors, it's going to be multiples of that. So very often we'll see extreme trauma. And if you think of a scale of 1 to 10, extreme childhood abuse or combat trauma, that kind of thing would be on the 8, 9, 10 of the scale. And then a day irritation in traffic or a minor irritation with someone at work would be like a 1 to 2. So daily struggles around the 1, 2 region, the big stuff's at 8, 9, 10. And the middle of the stuff are potentially bad habits and patterns we're potentially getting into that are disruptive to our lifestyle. So if all of them need attention. And how do we pay attention? We pay attention through our mind management. We manage our mind. And when we manage our mind, we actually change the psychoneurobiological network. So when we manage our mind and we change the psychoneurobiological network in the right time frames, that's when behavior change will happen. So something like habit stacking, it depends on what you're trying to change. if you've got a complex issue that you're dealing with an 8, 9, 10, even something in the 5, 6, 7 region, habit stacking is more like a technique to support once you've actually resolved the issue. And then it's supporting what I would call the step 5 of the process that I've researched and developed that helps you to change your networks. It's a planned and guided process that you do daily over these cycles of 63 days, 5 to 15 minutes. You can go a little longer if you want to. But essentially, the key with making any kind of change, any kind of habituation, the change that becomes a habit that is useful to you, is a very planned and guided process over time. So that's the science of habit formation that we're also doing in the psychoneurobiological research. And so what we're seeing is that if you do bits and pieces in the wrong time frame, you will have change, but it won't be sustainable. And let's say there's something that is very traumatic that you've gone through and certain situations trigger you. Building and to deal with that, we have to completely rewire that network. You can't get rid of what's happened, as I mentioned, but you can change what it looks like in the mind-brain-body connection, which then changes how it plays out into the future. But that sentence I've just said has to be broken down into planned and guided process over time. Otherwise, it won't be a useful change. So we make changes as humans with all these wonderful self-help things that are out there and all the meditation, all these things, they're all good. But if you don't put them into the right psychoneurobiological framework, you grow a lot of little trees in your brain. And those trees are little. And if they're little, they don't have enough energy to impact change. So when you are triggered, you worked on it. But because you didn't build up enough energy, that old way of reacting was still equally as strong and maybe still stronger. That was how you then responded based on that thought. That thought came into your conscious mind and that drove your action, because our thought trees in our network drive how we respond. And if we haven't built a good habit, we're going to respond in that way. So the work that I do is to try and help people in the psychoneurobiological research is to understand how to do this daily practice in the correct time frames to rewire. But before you can even start that, you have to actually be able to recognize the impact that your patterns are having in your life, or even to observe them in the first place. Because that's the kind of a hard part, is you feel maybe depression or anxiety or frustration or whatever, but what does it actually look like? How can we start capturing that concept and breaking it down to the thought and going through that process? Otherwise, we're all over the place and little changes are happening. They do build up and over time, and they move towards in the right direction. But if you truly want change that's sustainable, where we can not pathologize or medicalize misery, but actually accept the pain we've gone through and use that in the right way, that's going to take a lot of organized effort, if that makes sense. Long answer, but it's because you have the bird's eye view of the work I do.
I think that's going to be very helpful for the remainder of the episode, because I want to take what you just discussed and now apply it to your new book. And I'll just say the title again, How to Help Your Child Clean Up Their Mental Mess. And on the show, I have had many psychologists and psychotherapists who have talked about the rise of mental illness across the board, but especially in children and adolescents. However, you start out the book by saying that we don't have a mental health crisis. We have a mind management crisis. Can you explain the difference?
Thank you for highlighting that, because it's very helpful and empowering when they understand what I mean by that. So I'm not denying that there's a problem. The implication of a mental health crisis is a very disempowering concept, because we think, what's going on? How come suddenly all of our brains are messed up and our kids' brains are messed up? And what's the cause? And it makes people very panicky. And people then generally say, oh, it's social media, or it's AI coming up, or COVID. And those are all contributing factors. But if you think about it, John, every generation's faced something. There's been wars and plagues before. It's not like this is the first plague we've had, or the first, we've had television, we've had radio. But those are radical changes, equally as radical in the time as what social media is. So yes, those are contributing factors. What I'm saying there is that we can't look to what our generations are facing as the cause of something. Social media is good. So is radio, so is television, so is AI. They're not the problem. The problem is, what are we doing with them? The problem is, how are we managing them? So that's one aspect. Instead of looking to an external cause as the cause of something like mental health, external causes do impact mental health, blaming something without looking at the benefits of it. So it's about management of it. So social media is not bad, it's how we're managing it. That's the one aspect. If a child's constantly scrolling through, looking at body images and the contagion aspect, whatever you think about the most is growing. So that if you spend hours just looking at how I think I should look to be accepted and my value is in looking that way, and therefore I can't get that way. So then there's cutting, and then there's this. We're seeing that a lot with social media, and that's why it's got such bad press. And that is a problem because that's not managed. If we can sit down as parents with our kids and teachers and adults, caregivers, whatever, and explain that isn't actually the ideal way, that person, and you are you, and you know, have conversations and explain how, as you're looking at that, you're growing it like a tree is growing, and it's growing faster and faster, and then it consumes you. And you've got all these ways of looking at the world and all these experiences. But if you think of it in a forest, you're just standing at this one big toxic tree that I'm not worth anything unless I look like that. And your whole life is viewed through that. You're missing everything else out there. So in order for us to re-engage with what's out there, we need to cut back on our social media time and grow some healthy stuff to balance that. You know, that's the idea of mind management. So that's the one aspect of the mind management, and it can apply to anything, that concept that I've just explained, whether it's AI, whether it's relationships, dealing with bullying, all kinds of stuff. The other side of the coin is that about 40, 50 years ago, we shifted how we viewed mental health and managed mental health. And it moved from being something where we saw the person in the environment. So a child whose social media wasn't around then, but let's take your example, someone who's been in a combat zone, that's a traumatic experience. So we've got to look at John in John's life and the experiences that you've had. And we used to do that. And we used to look at all the potential impact and understand that anxiety, depression, panic attacks, all these things, the PTSD, all these words that are not illnesses, they're actually descriptions that are giving us information. Because PTSD for you is different to PTSD for someone else because your experience is unique to you. So we can't silo or invalidate or decrease the hugeness of your experience to just a label. But 40 years ago, that's what we started doing. A drug was identified around 50 years ago called Promazine. It's a very difficult word to say. And it's an anesthetic, basically, and it calmed down people that were really in extreme states of mental challenge. And that started a whole industry of drugs that have psychoactive effects as ways of treating mental health, because it seemed to change people's behaviors. So it seemed like a good thing, but then it got out of hand because they're psychoactive, and anything psychoactive changes the brain. So there's withdrawal, and they're not fixing the problem. They're simply tamping down the intensity for a moment. But you can't just tamp down the intensity and do nothing else. You tamp down the intensity, then you have to actually tamp up the intensity and work through the issue, because otherwise you don't solve the problem. But that logical stuff that I've just said now, that started going away. The model subsumed mental health into the medical model. And the biomedical model quite simply looks at a symptom, and with the objective of finding the source of the symptom to eliminate the symptom so that you can function. That works for diabetes type 1, type 2, cardiovascular issues, autoimmune, these lifestyle diseases. It works for that, to deal with that consequence. A lot of lifestyle diseases also have their source in mind, because mind is driving the body, as I spoke about earlier with telomeres. But if you take that model and we take someone like your experience and we say, okay, John, you've got a TBI from playing rugby. And I work with so many rugby players in my practice. I just have to tell you, in South Africa, so many rugby players, goodness, so I can relate. And just say, okay, John, you have TBI, you have PTSD, here's some medication, here's a few CBT techniques, and goodbye. That's not enough of that. Or people will say, look, just live with it. You intensively worked to regrow your brain and change your networks, literally regrow your mind-brain-body connection. A biomedical model would just look at the symptoms that you described, give you the label, give you the medications, potentially multiple, they're actually drugs, they're not medications. Anything that's psychoactive is considered to be a drug. A medication is something that fixes a problem, like insulin for diabetes. But you would have been given that diagnosis potentially and the drugs and sent your way. And that's what's happening in the model. So for 40 years, you get asked questions. The focus is find the symptom, track it to the underlying biological cause, and then give a medication that treats the underlying biological cause. Beautiful, as I said, for basic brain and body stuff. But when it comes to mind, it's too simplistic. It's invalidating. It doesn't consider the whole story. And if you track the impact of that, plus billions of euros and dollars have been spent on this methodology, if you track the impact, what we should be seeing is improvement. Like we saw when you got the measles vaccine, people improve, or understanding of heart surgery and could do heart transplant, people live longer. So if something's good, people live longer. People are better. If something's not good, you stop doing it. In medicine, if a drug comes out and causes problems, they stop using it. But in the world of psychiatry and in mental health, there's been so much evidence that model has not worked. So a big contribution to the mental health crisis why I say it's a mind management crisis is because we've removed the ability of that. We've removed the sort of viewpoint that a person who's battling is battling because of. And let's dig into the story and let's support them in multiple different ways. And let's give them tools to be able to find the source of the issue and reconceptualize and rewire the networks and give them whatever therapeutic support's needed. And if they're in a really bad state in a moment, maybe a bit of the psychoactive drugs for a day or 24 hours or 48 hours or as needed if they're having a really bad episode or something like that, just to help them cope. But that takes time, takes a lot of money, takes a lot of effort. And does it really take a lot of money? That's been my question that I've asked, because you can empower a person to actually manage a lot of this themselves, which is why I went in the direction I did 38 years ago, because I saw this happening and I thought, no, I need to counter this and see if we can give an alternative. So the reason I said that is because the shift in the model, when you look at people differently and you see them as mechanistic, broken brains that you just want to put a part back that's missing, and you forget the whole story, you don't do justice to the whole story, that will create a crisis. So last thing I'll say around that is that federal data was released that tracked studies from 1996 through to 2014, 2015, and carried on. And what they showed is that people are dying 8 to 25 years younger from preventable lifestyle issues. And they're tracking that back to the time when we started changing how we, instead of looking at the whole human like I've been describing, it's become, what are the symptoms of the broken brain? And that's not enough. And even though we know there's life circumstances affect us, we understand that, somehow we just don't apply that. So that's been a bit of an issue. And that contributes to this problem, if that makes sense.
It makes sense. And it's crazy how by the time people are 60, 2/3 of the population is experiencing one, if not two, chronic diseases. And it all comes back to the way that we're living, the choices that we're making, and how we are incorporating that into our life over a period of time, which then leads so many of us to living the last 20-25% of our years with a poor health span, which is exactly what you're referring to.
Yeah.
So I was hoping we could discuss a couple of the core things that you bring up in the book. You brought up thought trees, which I love. The other person who's brought up this tree analogy on the show was Cynthia Lee, who's a functional medicine doctor, and she uses it to describe the current medical system and how with the protocols, we're dealing with branches on the trees or even leaves, but we're not really looking at the core system, which is what you're describing as well, as we're looking at our mind. But when parents are thinking about warning signals, which is something you discuss in part one of the book, what are some of the key warning signals that they should watch out for in their children's behavior that might indicate the potential for mental health challenges?
So there's four categories of warning signals. And the first one is emotions. The second one's behaviors. The third one is bodily sensations. And the fourth is perspective. Now, those are big words for kids. What I've done in the book is I've created a character called Brainy. And here's a little toy and a coloring book. And you would have seen throughout the book, Brainy is the character. Brainy, the idea is I can change my brain. I'm helping Brainy. So it's the whole ability that I have as a human to change my brain. So there's a lot of little nuances going on there with the Brainy character. Kids also relate to the cartoon, they relate to toys. So in the book, I do explain these concepts in a very simple way and give you questions to ask your child, whether they're 2 years of age or whether they're 10 years of age. In my other books deal with 11 and onwards. I break that down in very simple ways. For example, the four warning signals, I have pictures of Brainy, first warning signal to represent each of these signals. So you can show that to a child and you can find other pictures similar and that kind of thing. A warning signal gives us information. They talk about the word signal. They give us information about what's going on. So instead of seeing depression, not concentrating at school, a lot of sore tummies, not sleeping at night, and not wanting to play, and in a repeated pattern over 2 weeks as being, oh my gosh, my child's got some kind of mental health issue, there's a mental health crisis, you go to the psychiatrist, you list the symptoms, you have a diagnosis, probably depression, and probably given a medication, or if there's concentration, ADHD, instead of seeing those as labels, or diagnoses, or illnesses, or disorders, throw those scary words out and see the four signals as messengers, information, telling you something that's going on in the child's life. In other words, there's a because of behind it. So emotions would be depression, anxiety, frustration, fear, all the whatever emotions there are. Behaviors would be what you say, what you do, how you say and how you do it. bodily sensation, where am I feeling that in my body, perspective, how I'm looking at life. So if the child is very sad, that's the emotion, crying a lot, behavior, sore stomachs a lot, and doesn't want to go and play with their friends that they used to play with. There's something going on. As you identify those signals, that's going to then literally pull the protein tree-like structure that literally looks like a protein tree-like structure. And I have pictures of that in the book as well, of what they look like really. And then the imagery for the kids, it pulls that into the conscious mind. And as soon as you're consciously aware of it, it becomes weakened. And now you can model and help the child to say, I wonder why. And you start finding, checking, helping to find the source, and then helping them to reconceptualize. And so I don't have time to go through the five steps, but it's from the four, gathering awareness of the four signals is the first step of the system that I've developed called the neurocycle. So the tool of mind management is the neurocycle. This identification of the signals is the first step. And then there's four other steps. And you do those steps, they're very simplistically explained in the book with lots of little things you can do for young children, and the book's for ages 2 through 10. And then also what's really important, John, is for the parents to do it. The best way to help your child is for you to learn the system and do it for yourself. Children respect authenticity and respond really well to modeling. We all have issues. We're all a mess. It's okay to be a mess. So the best way to help a child recognize their signals is for you to, maybe you come home from school or work or whatever, and you've had a tough day and you just yell at the kids or whatever, or you just feel sad, to just turn around and say, I'm just feeling really sad and I've got kind of tension in my shoulders and my shoulders are a bit sore and I may be a bit snappy and today's just a hard day for me. I feel like this because of these things going on at work and I'm worried about my mom. Or, and you go through the process, then you engage the child, you're tuning into the child, you're helping them to see that you don't have to pathologize misery. You can actually, it's okay. As an adult, you still battle and challenges come, and that's okay. And we embrace those to reconceptualize them. So that's what mind management really is. And it starts with the signals, with helping a child to stand back and observe, why am I feeling like this? To be curious, it gets a whole process going. So when I spoke about the 63 days, the neurocycles, that planned guided process, you can put any, it's a system, so you can put any technique into that in the right place. All the great stuff that's out there, breathing and meditation and visualization and affirmations and lots of great stuff. But as long as you put them in the right order, the five steps will then change the networks over time to bring the changes that are needed. And it starts with gathering awareness of the signals.
Thank you for that explanation. And I wish we could have gone into more detail on the neurocycle, because it is a great systematic and deliberate process designed to help you put that mind management system into place. So something that the listeners will definitely have to check out in this book, but you've also covered it in your previous books, depending on what age bracket you're in. So one of the last questions I wanted to ask is, you have been doing this now, as you said, for 38 years, and as a best-selling author and renowned neuroscientist, what message do you hope readers and listeners take away from your book and our conversation today?
John, I think the most important thing is to realize that you can't change what's happened to you, but you can change what it looks like inside of you, your mind, brain, body network, and therefore how it plays out into your future. That's the one thing. And the other thing is, it's okay to be a mess. We all a mess. There's no normal brain. Great study came out of Yale talking about that. There's no normal brain. There's only unique brains. Life is messy and it's okay to be a mess. We just need to know that we need to manage that mess. Those would be two key things I would say.
Okay. And then Caroline, can you just give a shout out for your podcast and where the listeners can go to if they want to learn more about you?
Absolutely. My podcast is called Cleaning Up the Mental Mess, and you can find me on social media, Dr. Caroline Leaf. My webpage is drleaf.com.
Caroline, thank you so much for joining us today on Passion Struck. I definitely am going to have you come on again, because there were so many more questions I wanted to ask you.
Well, I was really enjoying talking to you, and I was thinking the same thing. I need to have you on my podcast so we can continue the discussion. So it'd be wonderful. Thank you so much for having me on. I really enjoyed it.
I thoroughly enjoyed that interview with Dr. Caroline Leaf, and I wanted to thank Caroline, Baker Books, and Mallory Campoli for the honor and privilege of having her appear today on the show. Links to all things Caroline will be in the show notes at passionstruck.com. Please use our website links if you purchase any of the books from the guests that we feature on the show. Videos will be on YouTube at both John R. Miles and Passion Struck Clips. As I mentioned at the beginning of the episode, we are now on the AM/FM 247 national broadcast. Catch us on your evening commute from 5 to 6 p.m. Eastern Time, Monday and Friday. Links will also be in the show notes, as will a link to my new book, which is now available for pre-order, titled Passion Struck. I can't wait to discuss more about this in the upcoming months, but I'm so glad that I can introduce it already to the world. Advertiser deals and discount codes are in one convenient place at passionstruck.com/deals. I'm on LinkedIn, where you can sign up for my newsletter, or you can catch me on all the other social platforms at John R. Miles, where I post daily. You're about to hear a preview of the Passion Struck podcast I did with social psychologist and Stanford professor Brian Lowry. In our interview, we discuss Brian's new book titled Selfless, The Social Creation of You. And in our discussion, we delve into the depths of introspection. We peel back the layers of conditioning, social expectation, and self-imposed limitations, allowing ourselves to emerge from the shadows.
We make decisions, not just how we interact with people, but who we interact with at all, based on these superficial cues. And so we don't really have the opportunity to engage with as many people in as deep a way as we might for those reasons. And that's really a hard thing to overcome, because all the evidence points to just the strong tribal nature of human beings. The nature of the groups shift around all the time. So there's nothing inherent in the groups. It's just that we tend to think in terms of groups and behave accordingly.
The fee for this show is that you share it with family or friends when you find something useful or interesting. If you know someone who is looking to understand more about mental health of their children, then definitely turn them on to Caroline's episode today. The greatest compliment that you can give us is to share this show with those that you love and care about. In the meantime, do your best to apply what you hear on the show so that you can live what you listen. And until next time, go out there and become passion struck.